Different time. So, good morning, everyone. It's Sunday, January 23rd, 2011. Today, we're giving a special class on informers in Judaism. Reason being, we have been talking for several weeks on the politics of exclusion in Judaism, and last week we hit on a Rambam in Hilchot Teshuvah says that a moser, someone who informs on a Jew to the secular government, loses his share in the world to come, and people ask them really phenomenal questions on this halacha of Mesirah. We're not going to discuss in terms of psak halacha as much as give sort of an overview in terms of what is a moser. We'll see, it gets complicated. We'll discuss a lot of issues. Most of the sources here are rabbinic because we want to get, you know, at least the rabbinic sources for you know, for the prohibitions before we start getting into modern day exceptions. Though we have a couple of sources later, some from Shulchan Aruch, some from Rabbi Herschel Schachter, who wrote a bit on it in simple English, thrown in there just for people to get a sense of, here's a way that certain contemporary people handle it. There are a lot of responses written on cases. Rav Moshe Feinstein has examples on this too. You know, there's a lot that can be said on it because there's so many issues that can come up, but you know, for something that's so severe, and we'll see in a little more detail just how severe of Mesirah is, it, you know, makes sense to first go to the earliest possible sources that you can. So that'll be the function today, and hopefully we'll try to at least elaborate and give some sort of explanation for why Mesirah is treated as severely as it is.
Question which I don't know whether it'll come out in the course of this discussion. Our rabbi was doing it at Sanhedrin.
Yeah.
And you know, talked about how the Jews never actually had control of capital punishment in their community. It was always the secular government.
It's hard to say that they never had control. From the Gemara, it seems to imply that they did. There are Gemaras about death penalty actually being executed, no pun intended there, like Rav Shimon ben Shetach, you know, and his own son being executed. So it's hard
to...
Yes, but when you say never in Jewish history, that's an absolute. We haven't had it in a really long time, right? But that's not to say that we have no... I mean, you could ask, well, is the story in the Gemara historically accurate? Legitimate question to ask, but at least it's something there. You don't have a source of my knowledge say it never happened. Has it been a while? Absolutely. And even at the time when we had the authority, you have one Gemara that says, even if a Beit Din actually went through with capital punishment, the one opinion, the most extreme opinion is once in 70 years, it's called a killer Beit Din. So even if you had the civil authority to mete out the punishment, it doesn't necessarily mean you went through with it because, you know, the death penalty was really severe.
In the same show, when Bishata hangs 80 witches on the same day, in one day.
Right. That is you. So, you've got, like I said, you've got stories, you know, from earlier about it, but it was, you've got different approaches to, let's pause it for a second. Okay, so while we were paused, we had an interesting discussion again, the rules. If anyone wants to make a comment that doesn't want to be recorded, just let me know. Pause, not an issue at all. But the main goal here is phenomenal questions to ask and raise questions of Dina Demachuta Dina, which we'll discuss a little bit later. Questions of what happens when the Jewish community doesn't have the ability to self-enforce. These are all fantastic questions. We may touch on some of them. We're certainly not going to be able to do it in depth, but for the purposes of this year, I want to at least get the parameters behind it to try to get some understanding of the basis for the severity. All right, so think of it more as a general, a general introduction to the laws of Mesirah, not intended for Psak Halacha. Everything really has to be done on a case-by-case basis because, you know, we're going to see, because it is extreme, it's something which you have to play very delicately with. It's not that simple, and it can lead you to some very difficult questions. And we'll see, even though most of the sources here are from the Gemara, we'll see some later sources that try to deal with some, you know, obvious questions that I threw in, but it is by no means comprehensive. All right, for the laws of, so don't take this year and paskin out of it. No, I'm kidding. I'll start us off with the Rambam. This is, and his laws of damages 8-9, which is in some ways a repetition of what we saw in Hilchot Teshuvah.
Okay, it is forbidden to give over a Jew to the non-Jews, whether the person or his property, or even if the Jew is wicked or violates commandments, or even if he caused sorrow.
Yeah, I can't type.
Yeah, sorrow or grief. And any Jew who turns a fellow Jew over to the non-Jews whether the person or property, whether it's person or property, has no share in the world to come.
Yeah. So here
I have to dispute the translation of metzelo metzelo. Metzelo means caused him direct suffering.
Okay.
Rather than just sorrow.
Fair enough. You know, you can't even do it. Right. So even if you were the personally aggrieved party, you can't turn him into the secular government. And if you do, and he's saying, using this term asur, it is forbidden. And he's saying, if you do so, even if the guy is a rasha, you know he's a wicked person, you can't do so. And if you do, you lose your share in the world to come. And operatively here, it's gufo and mamano. Gufo is if I take the person and I give him, you know, here's this guy. And mamano is if I give him the property over and turn it over to the non-Jews.
Is this a 10-plus question?
Not even close. Because this is only source one. There's a lot of information, and a lot of stuff is going to be in some ways clarified, in some ways muddled when we get through the Gemaras. So I'd rather just get through a lot more now because, you know, there's a lot to take care of. Can you take source number two, though?
Yeah, sure. So it's permissible to kill the moser, the one who turns a fellow Jew to the authorities everywhere, including today when we don't have the authority for criminal judgment. Umutal lehogo kodim shimso. We even allowed to kill him before he does the act of mesila. Ela keshama harini moser pluni begufo or bemamono vafilu mamon kar areitir atzmo lemita. Even if he's just confessing his plan to turn over a Jew to the authorities, even by that, and even if it's not over a big thing, even if it's just over a tiny
amount of money, yeah,
we can still kill him.
Yeah.
Umatrin bo, he has to get a warning. Vomrim lo al timso, we tell him, say to him, you shouldn't do it. Im he'ez panav, if it's chutzpedik, v'amar lo ki ela emserenu, I'm sorry, I don't recognize what you're telling me, and I am going to do it, then it's a mitzvah lehogo. It's actually commanded to kill him, v'kol hakodem lehogo zacha. And the earlier the better.
Yeah, first come, first serve.
Yeah.
Wow. So not only do you lose a share in the world to come, but even the threat of informing on a Jew, and where he's adamant about it, you kill him. This is Rambam, Hilchot Chovel Umazik, chapter 8, Halacha 10. The first verse that we did was 8-9. Wow. We're going to see like exactly where the basis for this is in the Gemara. But something to keep in mind here, I just wanted to start off with the Rambam to put things in context here. Does this remind you of any sort of halacha that might help put this in perspective? Rodeif, right? To explain, a rodeif is someone who is about to kill someone else. The guy's running, he's saying, I'm going to kill you, running with axe. Now, in order to be worthy of the death penalty, right? We were talking about this, you know, just a few minutes ago when we were paused. You need to have certain criteria that the Beis Din rarely actually implemented. It was very hard to do so. But if a guy's about to kill someone, you're allowed to kill him, no questions asked. That is a din of a rodeif.
Anybody's allowed to kill him?
Correct. First come, first serve, because the guy's about to kill him. But once you actually kill him, you know, the idiom is, you know, if you see him running after someone with a giant axe, you can kill him. If they run behind an alley and he comes back with a severed head and a bloody axe and he's not in the murderous rage anymore, you can't. Right? Then he has to, like, go through the procedure because he's already done it. It seems, in a way, that this law of Misira is analogous to Rodef in that way.
And therefore done for the benefits of the Mosir. In other words, we are saving his soul from committing an act that would...
Well, that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is you can do it to save other people. Meaning, but that only applies to certain... You only have that for murder, right? But if someone says, I'm going to do an Avera, you don't just say randomly, well, you're about to eat, you know, something not kosher, and so I'm going to kill you lest you violate a mitzvah.
So I understand that, but I think that Rambam definitely goes all out to say and emphasize that this is really just like Rodef, because he's the
Well, we'll see exactly where it comes through. I'm saying that to read it that favorably isn't, I would say, the best read, because we don't kill people when they're about to do any Zerim. Mm-hmm. However, for a Rodef, you can say you're killing someone to save someone else's life. Or if you let this person go, you're putting someone else at risk. You can say, theoretically, the same thing as a Moser, in terms of if you turn people over to the government, you're putting Jewish community at risk. Theoretical argument to keep in the back of your mind, even though it's not stated explicitly. It's a plausible read of the Rambam, right? Because when you're talking about Middle Ages, you know, the Jewish political autonomy was tenuous at best. Once you start, you know, informing on Jews to the government, you know, you've got a very different world going on. And we're going to, you know, now take it into the Gemara and see where did Rambam get certain elements from and certain parameters of Mesirah from the Gemara itself. Yeah.
I'm just trying to figure out which is worse.
What?
You know, in one place he says he loses a share in the world to come, in the other place he loses his life.
Mm.
All right, so in Rambam's view, which one's worse? I mean, why didn't he...
You mean, is it worse to lose? Well, in the second case, I mean, this would actually go to what Yori just said. If you kill him before he actually is Moser, he doesn't lose his share in the world to come. Right. He's still okay. Right? But if he actually goes through with it, he does lose his share in the world to come. You know, it is weird because, you know, even for like, yeah, it's...
I mean, why don't you say a murderer and an adulterer lose their shares?
In a world to come?
Yeah.
No? Because we don't have that listed as... I mean,
is a Rodef worse than... is a Moser worse than a murderer?
Well, that's a phenomenal question to ask in terms of worse, because I will throw this one out. I will throw this one out at you. You would assume... Something like, given the harshness with which the Rambam describes the punishment of Moser, that you would have an explicit statement to this effect. Does anyone know of a single pasuk, a single verse in the Torah, that says, do not inform on your fellow Jew to the secular government? You want to talk about murder? Fine. Lo tirtzach. That's easy. Right? Where do we find explicitly any biblical verse that says you're not allowed to inform? All right. Now, I think, you know, that question alone, you know, helps put things in certain contexts, or at least, you know, when you're trying to frame the question of just like how severe it is, assuming it's a rabbinic prohibition, just how severe it would be, unless you assume that it has something stronger in terms of putting your entire community's life at risk.
In terms of the Olam Haba, a murderer who does not repent and does not get the death penalty, does not get the Olam Haba.
Yeah, but anyone...
If we execute him, that's his kapala, that's his atonement.
But a Moser can also do tshuva, according to Rambam. Like in the end of Hilchot Teshuvah, he says even all these people can do tshuva, but that's like at the very end of that chapter.
The Moser was over at Kleinekite.
Anyway, let's get to some of the Gemaras
right,
here.
But, keep in the back of your mind,
yeah.
My question really is, what's the practical implication of someone having been declared as losing his share in the Olam Haba?
Yeah.
Does the community punish him, or, you know, what?
Ah, so, all right, so that's a great question in terms of, like, what happens with the community. So there are different rules for different things. For certain things mentioned, say, in the Rambam, you would have certain punishments enacted that we can do in, like, through the Jewish court system, and certain things that we can't, that, you know, even though we can't mete out any punishment, we assume that God's going to mete it out for him in some other way. Each law is taken separately, but depending on the severity, sometimes, you know, you lose your share in the world to come, and sometimes you wouldn't. In terms of what does it mean for exclusion purposes, well, there's, in this world, it could be a... you know, a sense of like, you've just really done something that bad, and we may put on a social excommunication for you because you did something that horrible. Right, a cherem in a certain way, even though it may not, you know, be a biblically mandated punishment for something. We saw that with karet. You know, with the punishment of karet, there are certain things where we have, Shabbat was a good example with this, where we're told if you violate Shabbat, you get the death penalty. We're also told you get karet, you get cut off. The death penalty is something that we, you know, humans, administer. Karet is something that God administers. And one of the Gemaras we saw was, yes, if you can't mete out the punishment, because meting out the death penalty is, you know, that hard to do, then God's going to take care of it and do karet. So, I'd leave it at that in terms of, you know, trying to keep it on one hand separate, like it's more of a divine sort of punishment, which because of the severity, we may then take extra judicial measures, even if we might not necessarily be able to mete out a set punishment for it. Make sense? Or a little more
so
sense?
Far.
All right. So let's start. Source number 300 source sheets is Gemara in Gittin. These are all Talmud Bavli. I don't think I put in any Rishalmis here. So this is Gittin 7a. Go.
Marukba sent for advice to Rabbi Eliezer, saying, certain men are annoying me, and I am able to get them into trouble with the government. Shall I do so? He traced lines on which he wrote, quoting, I said, I will take heed to my ways, that I sin not with my tongue. I will keep a curb upon my mouth while the wicked is before me. That is, he added, although the wicked is before me, I will keep a curb on my mouth.
Right. So, first off, to explain the context here and why the whole writing with lines thing, is that this Gemara in Gittin is talking in context of when you write verses, you're only supposed to do it on lined paper. If you look in the Sefer Torah, you've got a very thin line, you know, that you can't really see that's such thin, and the letters are all done, you know, in relation to that line. So that's the context here. Even when you're sending out a letter, you should have lines. So here, Mar Okva is having a discussion with Rav Elazar, and when Rav Elazar sent back a letter, you know, he's quoting a pasuk, he's quoting a verse, so he sends it back on lined paper. That's the context of the Gemara. But here you've got a case here where Mar Okva says, these guys are bothering me, I can get them in trouble with the government, should I do so? Rav Elazar says no, that even there's wicked before you, got to grin and bear it. Yeah.
Marukba again sent to him, saying, they are worrying me very much, and I cannot stand them. He replied with a quotation, resign yourself unto the Lord, and wait patiently for him. That is, he added, wait for the Lord, and he will cast them down, prostrate before thee. Go to the Beit HaMidrash early morning and evening, and there will soon be an end of them. Rabbi Elazar had hardly spoken the words when Geniba was placed in chains for execution.
Yeah, so, and the solution here is kind of like a happy ending of like, these people are bothering me, saying, well, have faith, God will take care of it, and poof, they died. Again, I just copied and pasted from Cincino for all the...
Kulal is definitely...
Okay. All right. Well,
colloquial use of kulal is a choke chain that you put on a dog, but I think it is
sorry?
Related to the collar. Collar.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Interesting.
On the neck.
Yeah, for all the translations of the Babylonian Talmuds, I use the Cincino translation. So I'm not surprised if, you know, they're more precise.
And also, I think Geniva is definitely one of those names that are, you know, made up names that are.
Could very well be. But this Gemara actually speaks exactly to the point that you mentioned earlier about someone who's causing you personal harm.
Right.
You can't inform on them.
And more than that, I think there's a mistranslation. Lo matzina de ikum bahen, meaning that I shouldn't take revenge of him, not just bothering me.
Good point. Yeah. Right. There is that element of nekama involved. Of, you know, it's one thing to inform, it's another thing you're informing out of spite.
Right.
All right, good point there. All right, next source we have is, so, right, first source very simply, people are bothering you, you don't turn them in. Gemara in Gittin 7.
He says, go learn something and God will take care of you.
Yeah, now, whether or not that happens, you know, practically, I can't really comment. It ends off here on a very, you know, nice ending, or at least if, you know, you're the rabbi of like, yeah, you know, just pray to God and who's ever bothering you gets vanquished.
It was done. So Rabbi Elazar is not Rabbi Eliezer. It's Rabbi Elazar.
It's Rabbi Elazar. Well, there's no yud in the.
Right.
It's yeah.
All right. Because the text, the translation says Eliezer.
Yeah.
What's this Elazar? Well, because it's pronounced as Elazar, as opposed to Eliezer. Is how you would have to read the Cincino. It's definitely Rebbe Lazar, because that's what it says in the, you know, Hebrew side of things.
So it's the Palestinian Amora, Rabbi Elazar, that is speaking to some sort of Hashub.
Yeah, he comes up a lot. I apologize, I didn't do a full... You'll have to come to the Tuesday class for that of Husu in the Talmud when we get up there. And honestly, I haven't gotten that far ahead yet. We're still in Rabbi Akiva, because it's a long thing, and we got snowed out 2 weeks, so we're a little behind. Yeah, if anyone's interested, this Tuesday we're discussing the death of Rebbe Rabbi Akiva at 7:30. Yeah, again, like the badger. Anyway, source number four.
You mean the death of Rabbi Akiva at 7:30? You mean at 7:30 we will?
Yes, at 7:30 we'll discuss it Tuesday.
How do you know?
Bava Mitzia, 83b. So this is Rav Elazar, the son of Rav Shimon, once met an officer of the Roman government who had been sent to arrest thieves, freebooters, latrones who overran Judea during the war between Emperor Severus and his rival, I can't even pronounce that. How can you detect them, he said. Are they not compared to wild beasts of whom it is written, there in the darkness all beasts of the forest creep forth? Others say referred to the verse, he lieth in wait as secretly as a lion in his den. Maybe you take the innocent and allow the guilty to escape. The officer answered, what shall I do? It is the king's command. Said the rabbi, let me tell you what to do. Go into a tavern at the fourth hour of the day, which would be, you know, in their time, 10 a.m. or the usual breakfast hour. If you see a man dozing with a cup of wine in his hand, ask what he is. If he is a learned man, you may assume he has risen early to pursue his studies. If he is a day laborer, he must have been early to do his work. If his work is the kind that is done at night, he might have been rolling thin metal without using a hammer so that he didn't attract attention. If he is none of these, he is a thief. Arrest him. The report of this conversation was brought to the court, and the order was given, let the reader of the letter become the messenger, meaning whoever gave the advice, carry it out. Rav Elazar, the son of Rav Shimon, was accordingly sent for, and he proceeded to arrest the thieves. Whereupon Rav Joshua, the son of Karach, said to him, vinegar, son of wine, meaning degenerate, son of a righteous father, how long will you deliver up the people of our God for slaughter? Back came the reply, I weed out thorns from the vineyard. Whereupon Joshua retorted, let the owner of the vineyard himself, God, come and weed out the thorns. I put in ellipses, there's a slight digression, a similar thing. He fell Rabbi Yishmael, the son of Rabbi Yossi. One day Elijah met him and remonstrated with him. How long will you deliver the people of our God to execution? What can I do? He replied, it is the royal decree. Your father replied to Asia, he retorted, do you flee to Laodicea? Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta had fled to Asia Minor in the consequence of having been ordained by Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba, which is in Sanhedrin 14a, in defiance of the Hadrianic Edict. So to sum up in plain English what happened here, you've got court officers who are looking for a guy. And the question is, can you turn him over? So in the first idiom, the guy, you know, said, well, what should I do? They're looking to, do I turn him over or not? And he said, well, no, you can't turn him over directly, but you can give him advice. You can tell them, when you go searching for someone, here are questions to ask. If he doesn't fall under these categories, you assume he's the thief. All right, because that way, you're not directly turning the guy over. You're giving them sort of facilitating. Is there a
guideline?
Yeah. You're giving them a guideline. You're giving them advice, telling them where and how to look without giving the person over directly. However, when he was called into court and, you know, to the office and said, who gave you this advice? Once they called him in to testify in court, he gets musar. He's called, you know, degenerate. It's like, what are you doing? He's like, you're vinegar, son of wine. Right, you are, you know, an embarrassment to your father for having done so. And his response was, but I'm actually doing a service to the community.
Continues with the pun. He says,
yep.
Clearing out the vineyard.
Yes, yes, he is. Look, Chazal are very big into puns. This happens frequently. And yes, it is very poetic in a way. Right? But he, as you were saying, like, it's, you know, just like you're comparing me to wine. What am I doing? I'm clearing out my vineyard of all the thorns. And the response is, God can take care of it. It's not your job. And it is a fascinating statement here. It's not your job, literally, to weed out the bad elements in your community. That's really what that idiom is here and how he's trying to defend himself. And in the second case here with Rabbi Shmuel, the son of Rabbi Yossi, right, he said, what am I going to do because my life would be at risk? And he said, your father ran away, right, in defiance of the government. Are you running away? Sort of saying
he was supposed to testify and he ran away?
No, no. Instead of acting in compliance with the secular government, he ran away to avoid the oppression, or at least to maintain his faith. He had the same expectation. The implication being, if your choices are, you know, let's say in America, you know, contempt, right? If you don't reveal certain sources in certain cases, or if the court says, turn over this guy, we would expect you to hold yourself in contempt of court or run away. Or
like a newspaper report with the sources.
Effectively, yes. I mean, I'm not poskening that that's the halacha, but you can see that from the implication from the Gemara, that is an expectation that we would have to avoid turning a fellow Jew into the government, even if you know the guy's wicked. Right? Exactly. Better you should flee than cooperate with the government to violate a prohibition such as this. And the idiom given is given over your people for the slaughter. Right? That's for, you know, the what they were thinking of. You know, you're giving out our people to be killed. We'll discuss that a little bit later in terms of, you know, an extreme punishment for theft. That comes up a little bit later. All right, take source number 5 in our list here. It's the Bava Kamma 117a.
Sure. A certain man who was desirous of showing another man's straw to be confiscated appeared before Rav, who said to him, "Don't show it, don't show it." He retorted, "I will show it, I will show it." Rav Kahana was then sitting before Rav, and he tore that man's windpipe out of him.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Rav thereupon quoted, "Thy sons have fainted. They lie at the heads of all streets as a wild bull in a net."
There's your pun again. Yeah, it just happens so frequently, it just doesn't make sense to point out every single one. But yes.
But it's beautiful.
It really is.
I think toys are water buffalo, though.
Again, I'm just all these translations here from the Cincino.
Isaiah 51:20. Just as when a wild bull falls into a net, no one has mercy upon it, so with the property of Israelite, as soon as it falls into the hands of heathen oppressors, no mercy is exercised towards it.
Yeah. So here's your source for where Rambam gets it from, that you can kill someone, right? I mean, what Rambam talks about is pretty much this case in this Gemara in Bava Kamma 117, where a guy's about to turn it over. He's warned by Rav to say, you know, don't do it, don't do it. And Rav Kahana basically kills him. And then the, you know, Gemara continues about giving advice to Rav Kahana to run away and whatnot. You can see what happens afterwards. But yeah, kind of extreme.
So the whole story with the execution of Yoshke doesn't make sense in this context. Because if he was judged by Sanhedrin, how could they hand him over to the authorities?
Not having that source in front of me, I can't even begin to comment. Sorry. Take source number 6, please. Nida 61A.
Okay. Amar Lava Hai Lishna Bisha Afalpi de la Kabuli Lomavi. Is that tough language?
Well, Lishna Bisha means bad language, bad speech, meaning if you hear something bad about someone.
Even though we accept it, we don't need it.
No, the other way. Afal pi de kabluni lo mibahe, even though that we don't believe it, say in a court, mechash le mibale, but we still suspect it. Meaning we're not going to prosecute you based on hearsay, but we're still gonna be concerned.
So
here's the case.
Negalila de nafakalayu kala de katul nafsha. So there was this guy from Galilee. And they said that that there was rumor about him that he was a murderer, that he killed somebody. Also, the comment of David Telephone, he went before David Telephone. Amule le tamrinan mal. What is the tamrinan?
Will you hide us?
Will you hide us? Tamil, right. Amal laho, right. Amal laho, hey, chinavid, how are we going to do this? Ilu atamrinuhu. If I don't hide you, then they will see you. If I do hide you, ha amur rabanan hay lishna bisha. Afalga v'lekabuli lo mabe mechashle mabe. So he said, if I do hide you, I have this statement from Chazal who say that language.
Well, not slander, but like a bad rumor, at least in this level, we should be concerned with.
Right.
Right? It says here, take note of it.
We don't accept it, we still are concerned about it. Zilo atoni tamgun of shaykh. So he says, you go and find your own hiding place.
Yeah, basically. Pretty much. So there's a rumor out that is, you know, this Gemara...
You said you had a lot because there's this rumor about you?
Right. Well, in effect, yes. I mean, what the Gemara... This is Rabbi... Right, this is Gemara 61A. So Reb Tarfon is basically saying, you know what? there's a rumor about you that you're a murderer. If I don't hide you, right, then they're going to find you. So it seems that he's concerned about, you know, them being found still, right, just even based on the rumor. He's not turning them in either, but he's saying, if I hide you, then I still need to be concerned about this rumor, which means there's a possibility it's true. Yes, I can't prosecute you in a court because, you know, if there are no witnesses, you know, et cetera, we're not gonna bring charges. That doesn't mean I can help you evade authorities,
wow,
right? Because then you're actually complicit, right? So here you have sort of a middle ground of. Well, here it's not even passive misira. You're not actively hiding something. Passive misira would be sooner the case in Bava Metzia 83b, where you give someone hints about how to locate. This isn't passive misira. This is when you have a case in a community if someone may have done something really bad. You, according to this Gemara, you don't actively help the investigation, but you don't actively hinder it either. You just stay out of it. Now you say, this is on your own, I'm not getting involved. Because if you get involved and he gets taken into the government, right, then you were just moser. If you get involved, meaning you turned him in, that's no good. But if you get involved by protecting him, then you're protecting a murderer, which is not good either. Right? So it's kind of, you know, it's... Exactly. Sheval Tase. It's the opposite of misira, of turning someone in, isn't hiding them, it's not turning someone in. For anyone who's an objectivist, the opposite of A isn't B, the opposite of A is not A, the opposite of B is not B, you know, but you can have a middle ground there. It's like, don't turn him in. On the other hand, don't have to actually help him out either.
There's one thing, though, I guess, in a practical way, you may be considered a source of the rumor.
Oh, right. So, and that's a separate question of, like, the legitimacy of some rumors and whatnot. But,
right,
you know, again, the Gemara is saying, you know, and this also, Lishna Bisha, in terms of, like, rules of Lashon Hara. I mean, it's one thing to say, like, you know, that guy, you know, dresses, you know, funny, versus that guy killed his wife, right? Certain things someone tells you, you know, you don't, you'll joke about one thing about Lashon Hara just being petty. You don't joke that someone killed his wife. There are certain things you just don't do.
So I think you have to distinguish the mathematical word complement as opposed to opposite.
Yes.
The opposite of good, of tzaddik, is Russia.
Right.
But
there's not tzaddik.
Tzaddik
is not tzaddik. There you go.
Right.
Great way of putting it. Take source number 7. This is back to Bava Kamma 117a.
And two persons were quarreling about a certain net. One said it is mine, and the other said it is mine. One of them eventually went and surrendered it to the Parangaria,
the Office of Public Service. By surrendering it, is he actually took the net and he gave it over to the secular office
of the king for confiscation. Abaye thereupon said that he should be entitled to plead, when I surrendered the article, it was my own property that I surrendered. Said Rava to him, why should he be believed if he says so? Rava therefore said, we would have to impose a shamta, a ban, upon him until he brings back the net and appears before the court.
So here's the exact example of turning someone's property over to the government. Meaning gufo is a little bit easier. Whereas, hey, you know, I've got this murderer in my basement. Here you're talking about a net that's held up. So I take this net, I bring it to the government, and, you know,
it's a fishing net.
It's a fishing net, and this is considered as if I damage property. So let's say the court hasn't been decided yet in the Jewish court. My defense is, well, it's my own net that I gave over as opposed to his. And Rebbe said, but why should we believe you that it's your net? That's the whole point of why we have this case. It's exactly. Once the case has been resolved, great. But for him to hold on to it and to say, well, only if the case goes against me, you know, then I'll get back the net. So Rebbe says, no. Like, at this point, the ownership is, questionable. It's undecided. We're going to put Yashanta, put the ban on you, which is where we got the chair. And we saw about that several weeks ago, the Gemara and Bowie Katan, where we spent spent 2 weeks on that. Like, there were a few pages that discussed the bans, right? The Shanta says, no, we place a ban on him until he can get that net back and we can rule it in our court. So, well, good luck to him. But, you know, you also see on one hand, you know, after the fact, right, you put him in Hiram until it kind of gets resolved. You don't kill him afterwards, right? You know, it's considered a bad thing. So whether or not, you know, loses a share in the world to come, you can put that on the side. But practically speaking, they said, wait, this is held up before court. We're going to put a ban on you until you resolve the issue, which also means you can resolve the issue by getting the property back. You know, in other cases, halacha treats it as by me taking your property and giving it over to the non-Jewish authorities is as much as what's the word? It's
not curable.
No, not that it's not curable. It's considered as damage. Like it's as if like broke it or otherwise, you know, did it some type of replacement.
Is giving it for safekeeping.
Well, if it's for safekeeping, that's not really turning it over. That's not really the same form of misira. I mean, misira is not the same as shomer. Meaning, you know, there's no problem like renting a storage locker or a P.O. box or anything like that. That's not misira. You're just saying, hold on to this for safekeeping, but you still maintain the ownership. This is when you actually turn over someone else's property. All right, so these are, you know, the Gemara's involved.
He's turning the net over to the secular authorities so that and asking them to decide whose net it is?
It doesn't even say about whether or not it doesn't even say that it wants the non-Jewish government to decide it. We'll talk about that maybe a little bit at the end about a distinction between. Actually, we can talk about that. We'll talk about that now. Actually, we can do that now. But it doesn't seem to indicate from this case that the secular court is going to judge it as much as you could do it out of spite of. Well, you know,
so
we're fighting over this.
Burning it?
Almost. Mm-hmm. But you can retrieve it and says, well, since we're still deciding it, get it back. Right? But it's not like, well, we don't know what the ownership is and we burn it and therefore, you know, did you burn your own property? Did you burn someone else's? So, you know, we're going to put you in harem until you get it back. I'm not sure if it's clear here.
It seems to me that, yes, this is all unclear. You're transferring the possession of it and the authority of it to someone, but it's unclear what they're going to do with it.
Very cool. You said two words there that I think really need to be distinguished. One is possession and the other is authority. And we saw this when we were discussing the laws of the courts in terms of going to a Jewish Beit Din versus a secular Beit Din, which does not come under the category of Mesira. Because if I take, you know, anyone here to a civil case in the secular court, that's not Mesira. I haven't given my money over to the court. What I've done is the court decides whether or not I give my money over to a fellow Jew. See the difference? Whereas when you're talking about a court case, you're not talking about acquiescing your money to the non-Jewish authorities.
Civil versus criminal?
No.
It's not even civil versus criminal. I don't think that distinction even works here. It's a matter, I think you said it beautifully, unintentionally, like kind of put it together. Yeah. One is, who has the property? It seems from this Gemara that you transferred ownership of the item. Think of it as a permanent escrow. Well, I mean, escrow is temporary, but like, you know, the court confiscates it. It's held up in the court. It's the court's property. Right, you know, such that they repossess something, right? That would be a type of thing where the court, you know, takes possession of it.
You effectively took it out of another.
Bingo. That would be the issue of Misira. But going to one of the Arkaot, the secular court, yes, there are other problems with it, but that's not Misira. Because that would be the court saying, I give my money to you, as opposed to me giving my money to the courts. Right, as opposed to say going, and it's the same function of a basin in terms of we take your money and we give it to someone else. The court kind of does the same thing. The court.
We have a prenup.
Well, the prenup is something else. The prenup is, well, we'll actually see a little bit about that.
It's a contract. That's something else.
Well, we'll see that.
Yeah, going to the court, the secular court.
So we'll see that a little. So we'll see that a little bit later in terms of how that works. But even what the court would do, the court doesn't take possession of it, that it's theirs. The court will take it to give it to another Jew and that they're enforcing a contract, which is a little bit different than turning the property over to the secular government. I mean, there's a difference of the court adjudicating a monetary matter versus the court confiscating your property. That's the distinction that I think is important to make here, because when we discussed Arkaot, no one mentioned anything about Mesira.
Right.
Okay.
But isn't there a general frowning on going to...
Yeah. I'm not saying it's permitted, but it's important to get the distinction of if it's prohibited, it's under a different statute than turning someone over to the government. Meaning, here's the big knock. I mean, according to Rambam, if I say, I'm going to sue you in secular court, do I have a right to kill you before you do?
No.
No. You see? You might not be acting appropriately, but it's not the same as Mesira that I can now kill you, right? And Kol HaKotim Zochet. I mean, if it was, we'd be living in a lot more interesting times. So, no, that's not the... Well, we're multiple spaces, depending on the instrument. Anyway, what are you up to? Eight. Who was reading? Who read the last one?
I read the last one.
Ah, okay.
Or did you read the last one?
No, it's your turn.
Your turn. Okay. So this is Bava Kamma 119a. Well, I'll take it then. If you did it, just go ahead.
I thought I just read.
You just read.
Okay, fine. I'll do this. So regarding the property of an informer, right? Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda are divided. So let's say you have an informer. There's a question of what do you do with the property. One says it is permitted to destroy it directly with one's hand, meaning you can just go and, you know, his property is completely worthless. And the other one said that it is forbidden to destroy it directly. The one who said that it is permitted to destroy it directly maintains there is an offense against the property of the informer could surely not be worse than one against his body. Meaning that if you say an informer, when he's about to inform, he gives up his life and that you can kill him, then it also seems to be that his property should also be forfeit. Meaning it's really weird to say that we can kill you, but we can't take your stuff, right? This is the logic that's being argued here. However, and which may be incapacitated to the extent for sake of public safety, whereas the one who held that it is forbidden to destroy it maintains that the informer might perhaps have good children, as it's written, may the wicked repair, but the just shall put it on. Yeah,
right.
But the fact is, you know, Mesirah was severe enough that there was actually an opinion. I believe the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch don't hold of the severe way, that they actually hold that the property is forbidden. Rambam and Shulchan Aruch separately, and Shulchan Aruch, don't say that the property is forfeit. They say no, because if the kids are okay, you don't penalize the kids for something that the father did. Yeah. So, but it shows that there was even the thought that his property would be forfeit.
Well, they had, I guess, in those days, again, the concept of primogeniture, right? The oldest son inherits everything, right?
No, the oldest son inherits double, and then it gets divided up.
Oh, they do?
The oldest son gets divided up a double portion. That's biblical law. And there are actually gemaras that go into a whole lot of detail about, you know, the combinatorics involved. But there is an advantage given to the oldest son. All right. So now we're going to get to a couple of sources in the Shulchan Aruch. So this kind of lays the groundwork. We don't have, to my knowledge, an explicit statement of it is asur to give over someone, even in rabbinic literature that I know of, or at least not in the same as asur or ein. In that statement, doesn't mean it's mutar. We have a bunch of sources that say you really shouldn't do this, and there certainly is a concern about it. To my knowledge, I haven't found. I mean, I could also. It's very possible I'm just missing a very obvious Mishnah, and I acknowledge that completely, and I just overlooked it. But at least I haven't seen a place where it actually says here it is forbidden. There certainly isn't a pasuk. That much I can tell you. There's no verse that says you can't. At best, it's rabbinic. But it's something that is, even if it is just rabbinic, it is incredibly serious, right? You know, you could imagine, you know, what this would apply like today. And, you know, the reality that they lived in the time of Chazal was, you know, one sort of political reality in terms of what their relationship was like with the secular governments, both in terms of, you know, oppression, and both in terms of what you could take care of internally. As there's a lot more integration, you know, this raises a whole lot more questions. Well, there are two issues. One is integration with the secular world, and the other is, do we have the capability to self-enforce? You know, which comes up sometimes with arkaot, but there are other issues of, you know, if you have you maintained a just Jewish society, if they know, well, I can just do whatever I want and no one's going to turn me in. So I brought in a couple of sources here from Shulchan Aruch Ramah, and so we'll look at these. Again, it's not comprehensive, and I'm putting these in to give some indicator of, even though you see the severity of what it meant in the time of the Gemara, here are some ways that later authorities dealt with it in their own contemporary issues. All right, Arah take number 9. This is Shulchan Aruch Hoshin Mishpat 388:12. Arkaot are secular courts.
Whoever informs on the masses and causes them harm, it is permitted to turn him over to the non-Jewish authorities to hit him, imprison him, or to fine him. but for the trouble of an individual, it is forbidden to turn him over to the non-Jewish authorities.
Right.
So it's an individual.
Right. So yeah. There's a distinction Shulchan Aruch is making of, if the person just, you know, ticked off you as a person, like, can't do anything about it. But if what he does puts the community at risk, then you can. Here's the Ramah, commentator on the Shulchan Aruch, who gives his own detail behind it.
Someone who works in fraud, forgery, counterfeit, etc., mm-hmm. and the like, we may suspect that this damages the masses. We warn him not to do so, and if he refuses watching, it is permitted to turn him over and to say that no one else is doing this sort of thing except him.
Right, so stop here for a second. So this is already a very specific case. You have a counterfeiter, right? Can you turn the guy over? And according to the Rama, yes, it's possible to argue that even such a case puts the masses at risk. Right, so even though counterfeiting we wouldn't necessarily consider to be a capital offense, because it puts a whole community at risk, right, according to Rama, can turn him in. We'll let him finish and then we'll get to the other questions. Yeah.
Someone who wishes to run away and not pay the non-Jewish government what he owes, and someone else reveals this fact, this person is not considered an informer since he did not cause him a loss, but rather he is requiring the man to pay what he already owes. In any event, he did something wicked for it, as if he returned a lost object to a non-Jew, and if in the process he causes the person damage, he must pay the damage of what he caused.
All right, so this requires a little bit of explanation here. So first, Rama is saying that if the guy owes the government money, so turning him in isn't misirah, because you're not turning over his money, it's money that he owes to the government. Right? Because let's say someone doesn't pay taxes, right? You don't own the money of taxes, that's money that the government owns. Like, they actually can reach into your bank account and they can take it, right? They can garnish wages. Very powerful government we have. So that's not considered turning in a tax sheet. It isn't that you've taken over his money, because it wasn't really his. You're giving the government what the government, you know, has himself. So that case, it's not considered misirah, because you haven't caused him a loss. However, he says it's still bad, and he throws in two interesting things that we're going to see. One, it's like returning a lost object to a non-Jew. Odd idiom, because where is it prohibited to return a lost object of a non-Jew? Gemara says returning a lost object to a non-Jew, we do that because of Chilul Hashem, because of a desecration of God's name.
Yeah, I would
this, I believe, is Chilul Hashem. Darkei Shalom is elsewhere.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it's Chilul Hashem about returning the lost object. Please send me an email afterwards, double check, but I'm fairly certain it's Chilul Hashem. And that's important because we'll see a Ramah later where Chilul Hashem comes into play here. But he also says, let's say in the process he causes damage, he must pay the damage he caused. Now, this would have a very interesting implication, because let's say a guy owes, super amounts of money for taxes. So one is the amount he owes in taxes, so that wouldn't be an issue. Would you say penalties on a top of that would be considered, or are those things that the government, you know, is part of the law? Or what's another good way? Punitive damages in a weird way, right? So if, you know, they took on like additional punitive damages, you'd be on the hook for that according to the Rama, even if the base. Correct. Because even
it's more money than
it's more because it's punitive as opposed to what he owes. You might even say that the additional fees are what he owes to the government, because the government sets up the rules of when you're delayed in taxes, here's what you need to play plus their interest plus their stuff. But if they add on additional fines,
right,
then according to Rama, it would seem to me you would be held liable for the fines here. But so this gives you a very interesting distinction. This goes back to the argument about the prenuptial agreement.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you add the additional punitive damages, wouldn't they be simply the cost of doing business to the original?
That's not what a punitive damage is by definition. You're doing a punitive damage to punch, like you've got regular damages, which is here how much damage you owed. But here's punitive damage because you were really arrogant about
punitive
it.
Punitive damages can many times be three times what you owe.
Yeah, and then they generally get cut down on appeal, which is what happens.
Yeah,
but
why would that? Why would that? Could that go on the account of the person?
Because that's not the money he owed. It's one thing to say that, let's say I owe the IRS money. I don't owe the IRS money. This is hypothetical. I actually got something in the mail from the IRS that through some mapping I owed 53 cents. And they actually said, we're waiving this, do not send a check. It's a really funny letter that was just so nerve-wracking when I was like, wait, I thought I took care of this. Like, do you owe some nominal fee? Yeah, we don't care. But yes, I'm all paid up with my taxes, so they're not after me.
It's funny that way because I was just, what the IRS does is they have a percentage and they base it on sometimes a monthly thing. So you could actually settle with the IRS for a certain sum and then you could get... end up when they actually bill you for three times that sum, because all of a sudden they say, well, you owe this extra. So it's very, you've got to be very
careful. So here would be they told me don't send in a check. That's very straightforward. Here's the issue, though. So, like, let's say I happen to owe the IRS $1 million in back taxes and fees together. Just using a big round number, it's usually, you know, down to the cents thing. Obviously, if they're going to say you owed 53 cents. And, they're medactic about this. Very strict on the numbers. So I owe $1 million. That first $1 million is what I owe the government, right? Because back taxes plus the fees that they, you know, attributed. Because everyone knows when you don't pay taxes on time, there are associated fees plus there's interest that you owe the government. The court can say, because you were so negligent about it, or because I fled to Switzerland to avoid paying taxes, and this has been going on for, say, 15 years, they can say, well, we're also going to put an additional punitive fine of $5 million. So that extra $5 million wasn't what I owed the government. That was what the court decided after the fact. The only thing I owed the government was $1 million, right? That extra five, though, I'd be on the hook, or whoever informed on me.
Direct result.
Bingo. Because of the direct result, and because it wasn't part of the sum of what I had initially owed, would be very different.
The only thing in a practical sense is it could be questionable that the sum that the government claims you owe may not be correct.
Well, that's possible, too. A friend of mine just had an issue with a parking ticket that popped up that was 4 years old. And he said, this is clearly a computer error. They said, yeah, but it's like so many years old, you can't even appeal it. Mm-hmm. Not saying that, all that aside, I mean, we'll get into that maybe a little bit in the last source, but yes, definitely a good point. Gary? Yeah, sorry, you had a question, and then you're... Dan had a question. I just read. Dan had a question.
Yeah, so the Schopenhauer talks about a mosaic.
Yeah.
And the Ramah talks about a forger.
In terms of informing on the forger. Meaning, because he's hurting the masses.
He's hurting the community.
Oh, okay.
Right, Yeholin Limsoro. Right, you're allowed to inform on the forger. That's the whole point, because he explained this as a case where the masses are, you know, put at risk. Yuri, take number, source number 10. This is Shulchan Aruch Choshen Mishpat 28:3.
If a goy sues a Jew in secular court, the Yesh Yisrael Yedei do it lo bet kochavim neged Yisrael. So there's a Jew who can bear testimony against the Jew in favor of the goy. The ein ed elahu, and there's no other witness. So he's being subpoenaed by the goy to come and testify in a situation where the secular laws would accept a single person's testimony to win the case for the goy against the Jew. The Jew is not permitted to testify. If he did testify, then the rabbis can take out a
curse on him.
Whatever, right. Now, the proof?
Well, the Ramah.
Right.
Well, it's not a proof, it's commentary, doesn't it?
Right.
He argues more than he proves.
Aval eino chayav l'shalem. But he, even though we put a cherem on him of some kind, he doesn't have to pay the loss of the olomal. Emet he'adati. All he has to say is, I test the truth. Aval im yesh levarer shesheker he'i, but if we can find out that he gave false testimony, chayav l'shalem, and that cost the Jewish defender a hefty penny, that he has to pay. V'im bal davar mudeh she'emet he'id, if the goy accepts that testimony was truth, and b'shem kinato, and then in that case, if the outcome of the court was that the plaintiff accepted the testimony,
I would think it would mean the defendant. Baldavar. Yeah, because it could, Baldavar just means a participant, okay, but Baldavar, I think in context here means if the Jewish defendant admitted that the other Jew's testimony against him was true,
then we don't,
no damage. He set him as a designated. Like he said, you are my star witness.
Right.
And you are my only witness before. And he tells the Jew this.
So, if he says, I expect the truth from you and you will not come forth with the truth, then it's right. Hashem, and you have an obligation to testify.
Well, so I put that in, this in here for an important reason. I mean, one, you have the Ramah using this idiom of Chilul Hashem, which is if you want to give the analogy of returning a lost object to a non-Jew, you're allowed to suspend that when there's going to be a Chilul Hashem, why it's not a problem. But it's also important to realize there, even though the Shulchan Aruch doesn't like it, and there's says, don't do it, we can put you in chayim, we don't consider you a moser, right? If you are called in to testify, you haven't given someone over, you're called to say, state the facts as you know it. I mean, the guy's already been taken to court, which is also a little bit different from the Gemara that we saw earlier on source number 4, Bava Metzia 83b, of when Rav Elazar was called into... Or Rav Elazar was called into the court to say, well, who is the one that told you this advice? And he said, I was the one that did it. And they treated him as, how could you possibly do that? Even though, practically, he gave someone advice and he testified in court that he gave someone the advice about how to find him. He was considered as bad. Whereas, according to Shulchan Aruch, there's a distinction between actively turning someone over to the court versus participating in the civil judicial process, even if it causes the Jew to lose money to a non-Jew. Because you haven't turned him over, the facts have turned it over. You weren't the one who turned him into the court necessarily, but it's through your actions that it happened. So even though it's a case where it's not ideal, it's still not considered mesira.
Right.
That would be a distinction.
Now there's a sentence that was not translated. Is that because it was actually someone else's commentary? It was Mordechai?
No, that was translated.
In Baldavar Modesh.
We translated it. I must have skipped that. I apologize. Oh, okay. That was an oversight on my part. Nothing against the Mordechai. But yeah, so thank you, Yori, for reading that in the Hebrew. Happens from time to time. So the next two sources are both from Rabbi Herschel Schachter at Yeshiva University, who's written a bit on Mesirah. I combined these two into one big source. I don't read number 11. The first source is from the very first RJJ journal, the Journal of Halach and Contemporary Society. The article that he wrote is on Dina de Malchut Dina, which means the law of the land is the law. And it has many implications for, following the parameters for when you follow the civil court and when you don't. I would recommend, it's a long article, very complicated. I would recommend everyone read it. Fine, it's in English, so everything is copied from it straight. And the second source here is something called Regarding the Sirah, which someone posted to me on Facebook, gave the link, which is there on Torah Web, which is, as they said, an addendum to an audio class he gave in 2006 in Teaneck. That's about 45 minutes. Anyone who wants to get the full opinion of Herschel Schachter on the Sirah, go, feel free to listen to it. Again, the intent of me including it here is to give you one contemporary application of Mesirah and how it addresses some of the issues today. Alright? That's the intent here. Not telling you when Paskin or not Paskin like this. Not the intent, but rather to show what are some of the parameters, an example of how it's applied. Again, take source number 11, the source from Dina de Malchut Dina.
Moser is one who aids a pirate or a crooked government official or a tyrant king to obtain money illegally from his fellow Jew, even if the Jew has actually done something wrong. But if the secular government or the ruler would exact a punishment far beyond that which the crime should require, then it is likewise forbidden to report him. If, however, the government is entitled to its taxes or is permitted to punish criminals as offenders, there is no problem of Nasirah in informing government officials of the information needed for them to collect their taxes or to apprehend their man.
So Rav Schachter, in this paragraph, makes a huge distinction that we haven't seen before.
This is more really to my type.
Well, I mean, it seems, yeah. I mean, this article is written in 1981, is when he's writing it. But he's making a distinction. I mean, so yeah, we're definitely fast-forwarding over several hundred years of Jewish law. However, certainly based on the Gemara, this is a huge, huge distinction, exception. We're making a distinction between a just government and a non-just government. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, on this paragraph, Rav Schachter did not include any footnotes. So I don't know where he's based. Well, there are certain statements which we've seen in the Shulchan Aruch, for example, needed for them to collect their taxes. Seems to be based off the Shulchan Aruch that we just saw, that it's money owed to them. As far as criminal stuff, that we haven't seen, or at least I'm not saying that he made it up. What I am saying is that I don't know where it's getting from because it wasn't footnoted, and I can say that it seems to be very different than what the Gemara says. And it's a very different read. You could also argue that the Ramaz distinction was very different than the Gemara, but at any rate, you can sort of intuitively see what are some of the challenges that he's resorting to, because if you come out and say never inform under any circumstances, opens you up to a whole bunch of other trouble, and there is a distinction to
be... Also,
yeah.
It seems to me like from the first sentence, someone obtaining money from a fellow Jew, well, I think the problem you have now is since the... religious community and the secular community is probably all integrated in the sense that if we pay our taxes to the government, then the government's money is also made up of Jewish people's money. So if someone's defrauding the government in some way...
Yeah, I don't think that comes up here, though, because you're still having the secular government take care of it. But it says here to obtain money illegally, and he also makes another distinction of whether or not it's a just court, of if the court will punish excessively. He does say in the next paragraph, not necessarily on the sheet, but the next paragraph in the article, that just because they impose a penalty greater than Torah doesn't necessarily make it bad. But he doesn't explicitly define the rule of this part is excessive and this part isn't.
Right, and how you determine it, right?
Oh, leave that as an open question now, but that's another distinction that he will make.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Is the whole thing online?
Not this article. The regarding Masira one is, and the audio lecture are both online.
The argument he's making is very weak.
I wouldn't even say it's an argument as much, because this, again, without the footnotes and to know what he's basing this on, it's very hard for me to comment or justify. Again, not saying that he's making this up entirely, but I would very much would have liked to have seen what is the source of this distinction, where did that person get it from.
And I'm fascinated by the pirate versions.
Again, this is just a direct quote from the RJJ Journal. It's number one. Feel free to look up. So in the next source, I'll finish this off here, is regarding Masirah. So this is actually in its entirety from TorahWeb.org. And from there you can also, if you search for Rav Schachter Masirah, this will probably come up. And on this website, you will get the link to the audio.
This is 206.
December 3, 2006, he gave a lecture in Teaneck that had an audio recording. I checked it briefly. It was 45 minutes. I admit I didn't listen to it. He gives this year very differently than I do. Just really runs through stuff and a lot of quotes and whatnot. And there isn't a lot of digestion of, wait, what exactly did this mean? Like, why are you citing this source here? What about that source? Like, he just flies through a whole lot of sources. So it can sometimes be difficult to follow. Well, it can be difficult for people to follow. Other people who are more accustomed to it just know that this is how it is. But, recommend giving it a whirl, see what you think. More than happy to schmooze about it afterwards. So here's what he writes in this addendum. The prohibition of Nasir is well known to religious Jews. The severity of this Isur becomes so clear when we read in Shulchan Aruch that a Moser is Dino Ka'akum with respect to writing a Sefer Torah. He cites Yerageah 281.3 and with respect to his Shkita, Ramah 2.9. Even if the Moser is otherwise an observant individual and is meticulous in fulfilling his religious duties, because he demonstrates rejection of the unity of all Klal Yisrael by his act of Mesirah, he's treated as an Akum. Now that, I mean, here he's citing Rambam Hilchot Tshuva 3.11, which I don't think is what the Rambam says from what we saw. Rambam just says he loses his share in the world to come. And he's quoting Nefesh HaRav, which is a book that he wrote, citing about stuff. Well, it's a book that he wrote, Nefesh HaRav is a book they wrote of small snippets, vignettes about Rav Soloveitchik. Honestly, I haven't seen it, but I know, look, Rambam says he loses his share in the world to come. Whether or not that equates with, you know, treating as a non-Jew, separate issue, but we can at least agree with the big statement, the primary point of this paragraph, which is Mesira is severe in Halacha. That much we can agree on, even if we may quibble about the details and how stuff is expressed. If, however, one is guilty of a crime, and according to the law of the land, deserves a prison sentence or will be put to death, even though according to Jewish law his punishment would not be as severe, this is not Nesira. And he's quoting the Ritva, medieval commentator to Bava Mitzia 83b. We saw the Gemara, we didn't see the Ritva. One would still not be allowed, and a Dvar Avram, one would still not be allowed to hand this individual over to the civil authorities, because this is the equivalent of returning Avedat Akum, which is usually not allowed. In an instance of avoiding Chilul Hashem, so that comes up again, we would be obligated to return the Avedat Akum, so too we would be obligated to hand over the individual. Sirama Choshen Mishpat 388.12. Was that one of the ones I quoted? Yeah, that was one of the Ramas I quoted. So again, you can compare what you're combining a lot of different things here, and that's not exactly what we got from the Rama.
It's a fruit salad.
If the non-Jewish governmental authorities know that one Jew is concealing information about another Jew in order to save him from punishment, the Shulchan Aruch considers this a situation of Chilul Hashem. Which, as we saw, 28.3, which I cited, it wasn't the Shulchan Aruch that cites it as a Chilul Hashem, it was the Ramah.
Right.
So there's...
But he means...
When he says... Ramah's Ramah, Shulchan Aruch, Shulchan Aruch. He makes a distinction with Ramah Choshen Mishpat in the sentence before. Right? He considers it a situation for Hashem. Similarly, for many generations, it was a practice of that if a geneva had occurred, meaning someone stole, and suspicion had fallen on the Jewish community, rather than allow suspicion to hover over the entire community, the Roshei Heichal, the heads of the community, with permission of the Rabbanan, would inform the non-Jewish authorities who might possibly be the real Ganav. So basically, you can't do it, but the Gedolim, the great rabbis, could. Even if one is guilty of a crime, deserves punishment according to the laws of the land, but due to anti-Semitic attitudes, he will probably suffer more than if he were a non-Jew, or the state prison conditions are such that he will suffer at the hands of other inmates, or at the hands of guards, in a matter that is not prescribed by law, then it should be prescribed. Proscribed is... a prohibition.
Right.
Not proscribed would be not prohibited by Jewish law. Not prohibited, but anyway. Then turning the offender in would constitute Mesira, and since he added suffering will... Thank you. Since his added suffering will be Shelo Kedin. However, Mesira is permitted in situations where one is a public menace, or which, you know, we kind of saw before, or if one is physically or psychologically harming another individual. For example, sexual abuse of children, students, campers, or spouse
abuse.
And
if they would be abused, that's okay?
Well, it's... He's giving examples here, but he's saying in the case of abuse, you are allowed to turn them in.
Even if they would be treated worse by the authorities in prison and would be abused by inmates and guards.
Yes.
Yeah, it seems to be such. Or at least that seems to be the implication of what he's writing here.
Right.
Because if we suspect... so let's stop here for a second before we do the concluding words here. You know, it seems to be that, if I'm understanding Rav Schachter, his take is the biggest problem with Mesira is instilling punishment greater than Jewish law would demand. So, for taxes, for example, like we saw in the Ramah, you're not doing more than the law, you're expecting the person to follow the law. You're allowed to turn someone into the secular government to make sure that they're in line with civil laws. Seems to be what he's arguing here. However, you know, if there's a case where, because of the judicial process, it won't be just for Jews, then you're not just for you know what I mean. Thank you. It would not be
equitable.
Thank you. Much better word. It would not be equitable for Jews either in terms of due process or in terms of the punishment. Then it wouldn't apply. However, since we see that the laws of Misera are suspended when there is a public menace because the public are at risk, then you're allowed to be Moser. At least according to Shulchan Aruch. I mean, we didn't see a source for that in the Gemara, and honestly, I didn't have time to look up the Beit Yosef and see exactly where that came from. But, you know, we can sort of understand that if we assume that he's like a Rodef, as we introduce this into, that by him going to the government, he's putting so many people at risk, such that you're allowed to kill him before he actually informs. It's not that much of a stretch. Right, to say that it's because he's putting the community in danger. So if he's putting the community, if another individual is putting a community in danger, then sure, being a Moser isn't putting the community in danger because this guy's already putting the community in danger and you're trying to stop it. Right? So it does seem to be that concern of an individual is putting the Jewish community at risk. You can either do that by informing on someone to the government or by doing another crime that informing, even though under other circumstances would put it at risk, the risk you're putting the community under is worse. Right? So a murderer, you can say, is a public menace. You can argue that, although you could also say, well, the guy only didn't like his wife, so, you know, everyone else is safe because the wife is already dead. But certainly if you have, like, you know, a child molester,
right,
you know, that's pretty severe. So you can see why that's a public menace. He continues, the Jewish community...
If you only molest one child?
It would seem so, in terms of recidivism rates.
Yeah, but it's a case for anyone.
Yeah, my understanding of sex crime is that it's serial. It's not just one person.
If
someone does it once, in terms of extrapolating for public menace, I think you can. In terms of...
You know what the difference is? I think if a man kills his wife, it could be premeditated and it's just that one act. If someone's a sexual predator or something like that, they don't have control over their impulses. And the more they do it, the greater the impulse comes, and they tend
but
to do it more.
But what if somebody
and more.
Was only attracted to one individual?
That doesn't
and
happen.
His crime, according to law, is that it's a statutory rape.
But in reality, it barely ever happens that way.
Why not?
I will leave this up to a case by case basis. Hopefully, right. It will never come up. Hopefully, I will never get that question.
But the question is whether or not, simply by the severity of the crime, we determine that it's a public menace rather than individual.
You know, I'll leave that as an open question, which we'll get to it, you know, at the end here in a way. So here's how we conclude here. The Jewish community does not have the ability to investigate these types of cases. So when you say investigate these types of cases, let's face it, we can't handle things. I even gave once the example of Dine Mamonot, a monetary matter with Madoff. Right? He's Jewish. A lot of the people who were defrauded were Jewish, either individuals. No Beis Din in the world is going to be able to solve that. When, you know, he fools the SEC, when you've got professional forensic accountants who are trying to decipher all of this stuff, and they're having trouble, you know, following the paper trail, even in a monetary matter, we don't necessarily have the resources to investigate. So here's what Rav Schachter says. Wherever there are raglayim davar, ledavar, which means there are feet to the thing, kind of like what we saw earlier of the Lishna Bisha, that bad speech, that you have what's the probable cause, you know, to use a civil term. So that there seems to be a problem, the proper government agencies should be contacted to investigate. So there also seems to be a difference between turning someone in to say, hey, something's fishy, check it out, which is not the same as turning someone over in the same degree. Meaning, when you report someone to the police, there's one thing to say, here, so-and-so did something, versus, this looks fishy, please check it out.
There's no slippery slope?
I'm just reading and trying to understand what Rav Schachter writes. If anyone wishes to contact him directly, go ahead, feel free to do so and ask him whatever questions you like.
Very nice.
Just as in the other areas of halacha, one should consult a competent moreh ra'ah when faced with such a shaila. Just because one is knowledgeable in Yeridea Volume 1 or delivers a good pilpul shiur on sugyot in Nashim or Nezikim, it does not necessarily follow that the individual will be qualified to paskin on hilchot misir, lahakel, or lahachmir. It's a statement which he makes repeatedly. On the face value, I think we can agree with, in that not all rabbis are competent to answer all questions. questions. He happens to be very restrictive in terms of who he thinks is competent, but that's a separate discussion. And why I would say each of these things has to be done on a case-by-case basis, and why I avoided all inyanim of psak halacha. You happen to rewrite that it is sort of a fruit salad, and you know, quotes things that quickly, you're like, wait, does this really say that? Again, you can take that up with Rav Schachter, you can listen to the 45 minutes here, I encourage you to do so, but the reason why I included this here is that it gives you a solution, or at least it gives you a hadracha, would be a way of putting it. A way of applying it today, or at least certain guidelines held by one particular rabbi whom people consider to be a posek.
Did anybody in Williamsburg or Boroughport listen to this?
To Rav Schachter?
No, to this idea.
They wouldn't listen to this idea because of who said so. Meaning, it has nothing to do with the merits of who says what, as much as does the right rabbi say so. Meaning, for certain areas of the Jewish community, Rav Schachter is considered a gadol. For other sectors of the Jewish community,
what's a gadol?
A gadol, great rabbi.
Great rabbi.
Like one of the people whom he would say himself is allowed to turn someone into the government. Certain people hold Rav Schachter in such esteem. For other Jewish communities, couldn't care less what he has to say. Rav Moshe Feinstein on the Lower East Side is held in much greater esteem than he is elsewhere. Not to say that people might denigrate Rav Moshe Feinstein elsewhere, but the level is so different from Lower East Side and anywhere else in the world. Right? So there is a certain degree of subjectivity there, and a much bigger question of who gets to make
that
turn.
I don't know that it's just a statue of Rav Moshe Schachter or the concept that a Mesira is a Mesira is a Mesira.
It has nothing to do with straight logic of halacha. You can come, look, based on pure Gemara that we saw, it shouldn't be outrageous to conclude Mesira is forbidden in all circumstances. And yet, you see, you know, rationale saying, well, you know, maybe it's okay here, I'll make this distinction, I'll make that distinction. You know, just because you've got a logic to it, it matters for practical halakhic purposes. For other Jewish communities, it's very selective in terms of who people follow when, very inconsistent, usually based on, you know, whatever fits at a certain time. It's like why you'll find certain people that will be very strict about going to Beis Din and other times go to secular court. 9 times out of 10, it's based on where they think they're going to win.
So we can
not based on halakha.
We can agree on at least one thing, which is the element that Rav Schachter introduces.
I don't know if he introduces. I don't know if he was the first person to say so, like to say these things. You'd have to go back right and see where he got this from. It just, you know, it wasn't footnoted in the RJJ journal.
Second to it in Rambam or Shulchan Aruch.
Not that I've seen, and from what I've seen of quoting the Shulchan Aruch and Ramah, does not seem to say the way that he says that he says it. Does that mean that there is no possible way of... I don't know. I haven't looked at every single operant on this. And it's possible, you know, there is someone else who said it before he did. However, I would also say, just because an operant said something doesn't necessarily give it halachic legitimacy. Right? I mean, even the distinction made by the Ramah, you know, the Shulchan Aruch, about, you know, there's a difference between the difference between ownership, I think makes a little bit more sense, because then you're not Moser Mamono. Right? It's Gufor Mamono. It's his body and his wealth. You can say that if he owes the government money, it's not Mamono. It's someone else's. Right? So that's a distinction that I think makes sense in line with the Gemara. Some of the others don't necessarily see how that works, right? Even if you have an operon or another rabbi that says so, it still has to be consistent within Torah Shabbat Peh. I understand the reasons why people want to make such a distinction, because you don't want to be the guy that says, oh yeah, we're going to harbor criminals. And if there is a murderer, I mean, for things like certain severity, you can say that this is something on the masses. And again, by issues of Rodef, as interpreting it, I think they're plausible interpretations. But also, just because you have a...
You're translating Tzibul as masses, and I think it's just congregation.
More than an individual. When I say masses, I mean more than an individual. More than just, you know, I'm at risk, it's my community is at risk. Or let's say the same people that would theoretically be at risk if someone informed are the same people who are theoretically at risk by this guy doing what he's doing. Right? So those are things which I can see as plausible interpretations. Others might seem less implausible, and that's going to be subjective. Some people will look at it critically, and some people will say, well, this is a great rabbi, even though if I looked at it in my own, it must be, I'm missing something, I'm going to rely on his distinctions. And that has to do more with how do we perceive the halakhic process today. Yeah.
And there must be in history some point where the law of the land designates someone having the power to punish, and the rest of the thing, it doesn't matter what communities they are, they cannot fulfill a punishment.
But that doesn't always kick in. You had that Gemara, the one that we saw on, it was in the second half on Bava Metzia 83b, where it's told, like, you know, what should I have done? He said, yeah, you should have gotten up and left.
Right,
meaning, just
right.
Because of Dina Demachut Adina, but you ought to go to the court, but according to that Gemara, the implication of that Gemara is, when faced, when you're told by the government to violate Jewish law, in this case, the law of Nisira, it's better for you to leave than to violate Jewish law.
But that was probably at a time where someone would go from community to community and not be, you know.
It was harder to try. It's a lot easier to pick up and move to a different community now than it was back then.
Right. I think you'd be actually talking about moving either to another country or another.
Yeah, you'd have to move to another. You'd have to move out of the jurisdiction, unless like there are extradition treaties.
You can send yourself to a life of poverty and isolation.
Not necessarily poverty. No, Roman Polanski did pretty well in exile for himself.
I'm talking about Roman Polanski 1500 years ago.
Well,
would not have been so easy at all.
I don't know. Rav Kahana had to leave where he was after he ripped out the guy's windpipe. So. You know, he seemed to have done okay too. You can read up the rest of that Gemara. On Bava Kamma 117. You read the second, like the Gemara immediately afterwards was him running away after killing the guy.
What else is so interesting? You have in the government here, you have the establishment clause, all right? That means that the government here, if it's fulfilling its duty, the judge will not get involved in the internal affairs of the synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
They'll just leave the synagogue, like it has a board of directors, it has a rabbi. They determine everything within that synagogue.
Yeah, but
and,
criminal
separation of church and state, but criminal stuff has nothing to do with that.
Exactly. We don't have the ability to enforce criminal law. And in fact, if we did, or I shouldn't say if we did, if there was a basin that, let's say, gave malchut, right, whipped the guy, that basin would probably be brought up on assault charges.
You see, that's what I was trying to say before, with the thing. You can't enforce certain, you know, things within a community anymore the way it's set up.
Like the Islamic law, you know, there's certain things that,
some guys on
you know, there's certain things which, you know, can be done. And, you know, there's some really ludicrous arguments about creeping Sharia law.
Yeah,
you know, they're saying, the courts, but in America, and one of these cases was involved in Texas. We say, you see that the court is enforcing Sharia law. It's like, no, there was a binding arbitration agreement that was done on, you know, Sharia law. And they, you know, the court just upheld the binding arbitration agreement. It was no different than a beis din, right? You know, it was a civil matter. It wasn't that, you know, an honor killing, right? It was nothing like that. But, you know, if that sort of thing happened in America, you would probably find the court prosecuted. But for just monetary matters, no. But you have a much bigger cases for criminal stuff. Things like if there's a murderer in your community, if there is, you know, someone who steals in the community. But it is kind of severe. At any rate, you know, it's getting a little bit late. Want to cut things off. But again, just want to conclude by saying, the intent of, you know, this year wasn't for Psak Halacha, but in the matter of Misira, I wish that you would all be a little more informed. Have a wonderful day.
Oh, that was a bad one.
You usually are. Now, look, I can put in a laugh track post-editing, so. Anyway, have a wonderful day, wonderful week. Tuesday, 7:30, we'll get to who's doing the Talmud, and next week we'll resume with, you know, more politics of exclusion. Thank you very much.